At the February 2023 meeting of the Australian Catholic Historical Society, Dr. Edmund Campion, Emeritus Professor of History at the Catholic Institute of Sydney, presented a talk entitled, Can the Church Change Its Mind? An Australian Story. We join the meeting as the Society's President, Dr. John Carmody, introduces our speaker.
We have Ed Campion as our guest speaker, who was also, I'm reminded, from long before the time of most of us here, an honorary life member of the Society. So welcome to him and to everybody else. There's a little story attached to his title. Today is Can the Church Change Its Mind? An Australian Story. But when he first told me that he was very keen to tell this story, which is still a mystery to me, he mentioned Max Charlesworth, and I was thinking that he might put Max Charlesworth in the name. But it didn't. The first one was, as printed in the newsletter, The Church Changes Its Mind, an Australian History, an Australian Story. And then he changed it again to, Can the Church Change Its Mind? So I think that there are several questions that this talk is going to answer. But Eddie Campion is a bit like what Sandra Bate used to tell me was the case at the Ensemble Theatre. She said, there's a David Williamson economy here. Put on a David Williamson play and the takings go up by 25 or 30%. So I think that we can say there's an Ed Campion economy in the Catholic Historical Society. And it's especially with great pleasure, therefore, that I invite him to talk on Can the Church Change Its Mind? An Australian Story.
Fellow students of history, can the church change its mind? This Australian story starts with Lester Webb. Who was he? Lester Webb was an Anglican lay preacher and professor of political science at the ANU, who in 1959 led a seminar on religious tolerance at the University of Melbourne. He told members of the seminar that Catholics, if they got to power, might disadvantage, even persecute, Protestants and others. They would do what their church told them to do, he said. Where did he get that idea? He was probably a reader of The New Statesman. The New Statesman, where Paul Johnson wrote on the death of Monsignor Ronald Knox in 1957, that Knox had come clean about the persecutive principle being part of Catholic doctrine. In the first edition, 1927, of his The Belief of Catholics, Knox wrote this: a body of Catholic patriots entrusted with the government of a Catholic state won't shrink even from repressive measures in order to perpetuate the secure domination of Catholic principles among their fellow countrymen. So Ronald Knox in 1927. Knox was wrong, of course. And when he was told he was wrong, he removed that sentence from subsequent editions of his book. But you must be thinking, his error about religious intolerance being part of Catholic doctrine was understandable. This, after all, was the Church of the Holy Office, of the Inquisition, of autos da fe. After all, the Index and the Song of Roland, which celebrated the burning of mosques and synagogues. Thomas Aquinas had said, we execute forgers of money, as they did in the Middle Ages, because it was seen as treasonable. We execute the forgers of money, so we should execute the forgers of belief too. Such was common knowledge, shared by many who knew their church history. They had a print of St. Bartholomew's Day massacre in 1572 on their walls, a very popular picture. And Fox's Book of Martyrs was, of course, a favourite reading of theirs. Ask them, and they would tell you that the Catholic Church had a bad record on freedom of religion. And then coming to Australia in the 1950s, revelations about the Santa Maria movement seemed to add to this bad record. Was this further evidence, a papal plot, a papist plot, to take over political power to advantage Catholicism, or simply to disadvantage the others? So, in the decade of the 1950s, the news that the Church was planning an ecumenical council made freedom of religion a hot topic of discussion. Publishers became aware that there was a market for books about this, and editors of magazines sought articles on the topic. One of the local books was Catholics in the Free Society, published in 1961 and edited by Henry Mayer of the University of Sydney, a symposium of thinkers on both sides of the question. Catholics in the Free Society carried an essay by Max Charlesworth, lecturer in philosophy at the University of Melbourne. Later, he would include it in a collection of his political essays called Church, State and Conscience, having deleted, I might say, the introductory throat clearing, often a feature of academic prose. Charlesworth quoted Canon 1581 of the Code of Canon Law. It said, "No one can be constrained to embrace the Catholic faith against his will." And that implied that no one should act against his conscience. A footnote to Charlesworth's essay traced the Church's history of freedom of conscience from patristic times, Origen, Tertullian, Ambrose, Cyprian, Augustine, along to 19th century encyclicals. At the time he was writing, Catholic thinkers were moving to a position which defended the rights of conscience, as evidenced in Eric Darcy's Conscience and Its Right to Freedom in 1961. And I should pause there and say that when that came out, or a bit after, I was chaplain to a group of Catholic intellectuals in London, and one of them came to the meeting and said he had been that day at a meeting honouring Dr. Rock, the inventor of the contraceptive pill. And Dr. Rock had been asked, "Didn't you feel any hesitancy about this, given that you're a Catholic?" And Dr. Rock had said, "No, I take great confidence from Father Darcy's book, Conscience and Its Right to Freedom." And, of course, the London intellectuals thought he was talking about Father Martin Darcy, S.J. of Campion Hall, Oxford. And I was able to tell them, "No, Eric Darcy is a priest of the Archdiocese of Melbourne. And had I had foresight, I might have said, and he will become the Archbishop of Hobart." But there, we must leave Dr. Rock with his copy of Eric Darcy's book on conscience. And return to Max Charlesworth. He went on to assert that the liberalism condemned by various popes was, he said, continental liberalism, he called it, Lessing, Goethe, even Stuart Mill, which taught there was no true religion, that is, one that could be proved to be true, because there was no true religion, provably true, everyone was free to believe what they wished. And Charlesworth coupled with this the fact that liberals in power were willing to impose their views on others, particularly Catholics. In 1903, for instance, the French government had expelled thousands of members of religious orders because they belonged to a religious order. In Sweden, an advanced democratic state, he called it, in Sweden, Charlesworth said Catholics had been impeded from freely practicing their religion up to 1952. No Catholic could teach in a school. No Catholic could be a government minister. No convent or monastery could be established. And the ban on Jesuits was in place until 1959 in Sweden, an advanced democratic state. A year after Henry Meyer's symposium, Catholics and the Free Society, a long review of it appeared in the November 1962 number of Historical Studies, Australia and New Zealand. It's the trade journal of academic historians. It was written by Austin Goff, 1926 to 1997. Austin Goff is now principally remembered as an engaging university teacher, particularly of modern French history. Born a Catholic, nephew of a bishop, he was a schoolboy at the Jesuits' Xavier College in Melbourne, where his obituaries recorded, he simultaneously embraced reading and rejected Catholicism. So, Austin Goff. After war service, he edited a newspaper in rural New South Wales and so learned to write by writing. And then the history school at universities at Melbourne and Oxford, and afterwards Professor of History at Adelaide University, 1970 to 1991. Austin Goff wrote only one book. It's called Paris and Rome, and was published in 1986. It's on tensions between ultramontane and liberal Catholics, and it's a literary delight, that book, Paris and Rome. Its style, particularly the chapter on journalist Louis Veuillot, making one regret that other books he thought about writing, he would never write. Instead, on retirement, he went to Tasmania to play golf and write columns in the daily press. He died in 1997. 18 months ago, his biography by a former student, Don Longo, was published, and there it is. A Historian Against the Current, The Life and Work of Austin Goff, published 18 months ago. It's a well-researched, honest, fair, and non-adulatory biography. Let me say that it's hard to summarise the 6,000 words essay that Austin Goff wrote in Historical Studies. He seemed to be arguing from the evidence of its past that the Catholic Church was necessarily opposed to political liberalism and a free society. Catholics who thought otherwise must be, he said, suspect. Max Charlesworth and others like him, he said, were hopelessly unrepresentative. They and their favourite theologians, Congar, Kung, Courtney Murray, he said, were exact counterparts of 19th century French liberal Catholics condemned by the Church. He went on to say, the Syllabus of Errors of 1864, the Syllabus of Errors showed that the Church still held to its ideal of a confessional state where freedom of thought and religion would not be tolerated. Contemporary liberal Catholics, such as Charlesworth, were, he said, athletes of obedience in their acceptance of church condemnations of similar figures in the past. They were, he said, irrelevant as a guide to the future. That is, the papal church would not change its mind. The syllabus of errors, let me say, was a Roman list of 80 errors that believers were warned against. It was a papal guide to 19th century errors, pantheism, rationalism, materialism, and the like. It began with the error that God did not exist. Well, no Christian would hold this, perhaps. It went on to say that, as an error, that God didn't act upon mankind. Again, no Christian would hold that. Nor would Christians maintain that belief in Christ was opposed to reason, and so on. The syllabus of errors then moved on through contested areas of church-state policy, like the separation of church and state, democracies, the papal states, religious orders, public schools, matrimony, and finally, it warned of the errors of what it called modern liberalism, religious pluralism, freedom of worship, and religious toleration. The thunderclap final era, number 80, is often quoted, and I'm sure many of you have come across it in your readings. It says this: "The Roman pontiff can and should reconcile himself and come to terms with progress, liberalism, and modern civilization." Progress, liberalism, and modern civilization. That's what the official church was against in the 19th century. Back to Austin Goff. The appearance of Austin Goff's article in Historical Studies at the end of 1962 attracted the attention of A.J. M. Sayre, who quickly wrote a rebuttal that appeared in the first number of 1964-1963 of Prospect, a quarterly magazine run by the circle around Vincent Buckley at the University of Melbourne. Begun in 1958, Prospect was a vehicle for new thinking about the church in Australia. It was an unclerical, academic, cultural voice of the laity who might be considered liberal Catholics. Sayre thought that Goff's fundamental error was to consider intolerance, even persecution, a doctrinal cornerstone of Catholic belief. Goff imagined that Catholics would accept holus bolus, whatever a pope said. Yet people who lived in democracy were happy to be in a free society. They ignored or explained away ancien regime pronouncements of 19th century popes, such as the Syllabus of Errors. Contemporary theologians were working towards an acknowledgement of the rights of conscience, which could support a belief in the free society, rather than the error has no rights principle underlining papal texts. The second number of Prospect in 1963 carried a response to Austin Goff by Max Charlesworth. He defended his claim that the liberalism condemned by popes was anti-religious in theory and practice. Others, such as Catholics who call themselves liberals, weren't included in this condemnation. It was a theological question, not, in the end, a historical one. As for the debate on freedom of conscience, I'm sure you're going to tell me, the Second Vatican Council might be left to decide this. Prospect number two, 1965, also carried Gough's reply to Sayre's article. He showed that John Henry Newman, who famously said he would toast conscience before the Pope, had explained away the reactionary syllabus of errors from ignorance of its actual process of production, its history, in other words. Sayre, who followed Newman's letter to the Duke of Norfolk in this, was dismissed for his ignorance of history. Let me say this. In his letter to the Duke of Norfolk, Newman acted on the ethical rule of odiosa restringenda, that is, odious things are to be tightly interpreted, writing that the clauses of the syllabus applied only to the situation they had originally addressed. Newman opposed theological liberalism, not, in his Catholic years, societal liberalism, such as a free press. He sided with Montalembert and Lacordaire, and in the UK with Acton and Blennerhassett. Readers had to wait some months until prospect number four for Sayre's reply. Then he conceded that Gough knew more history than he did. Gough, in other words, had called his bluff. Yet he still argued that Catholics were not doctrinally committed to civil intolerance. They were still able to work towards a free society, whatever 19th century popes had said. At such talk of the doctrinal content of encyclicals, Gough, conscious of his victory over Sayre, said he would leave doctrinal content to the theologians. Meanwhile, theologians were already talking and writing about it. Footnotes to the Mayer Symposium had shown that Australian intellectuals were alert to the writings of an American, John Courtney Murray, S.J., 1904 to 1967. At the age of 41, he had become the lifelong editor of Theological Studies, which became a central theological journal in the English-speaking world. Murray used it to explore church-state questions, aware that the First Amendment of the United States Constitution was relevant. And let me quote it. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. It seemed to sit uneasily with the proclamations of 19th century popes. Murray's attitude to antique documents such as the Syllabus of Errors was to historicise them, to show that when the world changed, our teaching might need to change with it. He had his enemies, US theologians who had the ear of Cardinal Ottaviani of the Holy Office and other powerful Roman cardinals. These were error has no rights men who used their position to enforce their theology and to annul John Courtney Murray. In 1955, then, Jesuit head office in Rome told Murray to cease publishing on church-state issues. He obeyed. When Vatican II opened in 1962, he was invited there as a paritus. Then he was disinvited, I think is the verb, until Cardinal Spellman of New York cleared a pathway for Murray to become the principal author of the Council's Declaration on Religious Freedom, call from its first words, Dignitatis Humanae, which over 4 years battled its way to acceptance in the final days of the council. Consider some of its teachings, so novel to anyone who has read church history. Here's one of them. In matters religious, this is from the Vatican II document, in matters religious, no one is to be forced to act in a manner contrary to his own beliefs, nor is anyone to be restrained from acting in accordance with his own beliefs. Catholic doctrine. Here's another quotation. Someone is not to be forced to act in a manner contrary to his conscience, nor is he to be restrained from acting in accordance with his conscience, especially in matters religious. Catholic doctrine. Here's another. The usages of society are to be the usages of freedom in their full range. Catholic doctrine. What did Austin Goff make of such overturning of antique intellectual positions? After intense debate, bishops at the Vatican Council had voted in favour of liberalism, the rights of conscience, freedom of religion, and the free society. 2,308 for, 70 against. Goff was wrong. The church could and did change its mind. In other words, Goff was wrong. The church could and did change its mind. And let me add, Australians' liberal Catholics were right. Their critic was wrong. In the face of this astounding reversal, Goff chose silence. His biographer reports that he never mentioned his foray against Charlesworth and the prospects set again, except a brief passing reference to it in a long interview for the National Library. Austin Goff died in 1997, and his funeral service was held at Xavier College Chapel, with its celebrant, a Jesuit priest, whom he had taught at university. That's a puzzle. Why would someone who scorned Catholicism want this? The priest was instructed not to mention God or Jesus or heaven. No incense, although the Lord's Prayer and Bible readings were allowed. It's a puzzle. Don Longo suggested that a donation to the school's sports centre had given Goff access to the chapel for his funeral service. Perhaps one may suggest the chapel was wanted because it is, as those who have been to concerts there will know, acoustically resonant, and music was to be a high point of the funeral service. Well, like so much in the history of the church, this final puzzle remains unsolved. Can the church change its mind? Oh, yes. John Henry Newman said, change is the sign of life.
Well, as a biologist, I must endorse J.H. Newman, St. J.H. Newman. As usual, Eddie has given an elegant and meticulously researched paper, and it's now open for discussion and comment. Robert.
Thank you very much, Ed. Much appreciated. Ed, as you, of course, know, Pius IX, to some degree, accepted Bishop Dupont-Loup's distinction between thesis and hypothesis, although, so far as I know, he didn't officially endorse it. To what extent do you think that played, shall we say, a helpful role for church leaders in Australia and the Anglo-Saxon world to handle the issues of religious freedom? Thank you.
I'm not aware of any evidence that they knew of it. But what we do have is a speech by an Australian bishop in 1963 at the Second Vatican Council, who said this, he had the support of quite a few Australian bishops. This is what he said: "Is it really possible for an ecumenical council to say that any heretic has the right to draw the faithful away from Christ, the supreme pastor, and to lead them to pasture in their poison fields?" That was in 64. The same man, 2 years later, attended the enthronement of Archbishop Marcus Lone as Anglican Archbishop of Sydney, and the Anglican newspaper said that Cardinal Gilroy sat in the front seat and seemed to enjoy himself thoroughly at this enthronement of what his statement of Vatican II can only hold to be a heretic. So I'm not aware that they were involved in the... They thought it applied simply to other countries like Spain, possibly Italy and so on, but it didn't apply to British countries and democratic countries.
Thank you so much for a very stimulating talk. My question, I'm quite prepared for you to say that this might be out of left field, but apparently there is a bill to go before the Australian Parliament making it illegal for Catholic principals to employ, to look for Catholic staff. I'm wondering how this plays into this history that you're talking about.
Can I say that it seems to me that's a very good question which the whole meeting should discuss. I don't have any answers to that because I'm not aware of it. But can I say that when Catholic institutions were set up, they were staffed, to their great credit, by many, many Catholics who had vows of poverty, and that's how they got their jobs, that they didn't attract. But the movement of history has been that on these institutions, proper wages have now to be paid, and so they have to be open to anyone who can do the work. But really, I'd like to hear what others have to say on this matter.
I wonder if it'd be worthwhile to take up Father Reed's suggestion that we do have a discussion about this present legislation regarding discrimination. Why do I say? Because it affects Catholic schools, and I would be interested to find out from anyone here what I read in letters to the editor for The Australian during the week, that an argument against the idea that Catholic schools can't discriminate is that the Labor Party can discriminate against membership of people who belong to the Liberal Party for employment, and vice versa, and so it should be. So if that's true, then there's an argument, I would feel, for Catholic schools to discriminate because of how they see the purpose of Catholic schools.
The Anglican school in which I taught for many years had, an entirely reasonable clause in teachers' contracts that they should not teach anything which was contrary to the teaching of the Anglican Church.
I taught in a Catholic school for many years, and I think there was probably a similar clause there when we were employed, that teachers were not to teach anything other than, you know, they weren't to teach against the principles of the school, the ethics school mission statement and so on. But mostly, if you're teaching in a secondary school, you're teaching a subject, and most people who are Christians or good people, you're not really talking about Christian belief at all, so I don't think it really matters very much, provided the person is a person of goodwill and capacity to do the job.
I'm not so sure, because it's not, as I see it, a Catholic school is, it's not about just the subject and knowledge. It's about values and how we see things. For example, we see it from a perspective that the student is made in the image and likeness of God. That takes a different view than a state education. And it doesn't just mean about teaching mathematics. And I was a maths teacher for 40 years. But it's the question of how we see relationships and what's the basis of relationships. So it's not just about secular subjects. It's about how we relate to our students and how we see them.
This issue is in yesterday's Australian, and for those who are interested, and the Attorney-General Dreyfus is hell-bent on what has been raised here today about getting a leftist pluralist society into the curriculum in the Catholic schools. But have a look at yesterday's Australian.
Part of the problem arises, it seems to me, in politics. On the one hand, you might think that the Liberal Party, as is possibly shown by the last election, is in the process of, well, according to what I've read from Liberal Party members of Parliament, they're under great pressure to conform to the religious views of the membership of the Liberal Party. And they're under great pressure to be taken over by Seventh-day Adventists, Mormons, and conservative Catholic and Protestant elements in their particular churches. That's one thing. On the other hand, they're obliged to tailor their cloth according to whether they want to get their pre-selections again. So that's one thing. And the previous government did try very hard to put in a religious discrimination bill, and they didn't know how to do it, really. And part of the problem seems to me to be the right at the very end of the Constitution is the provision that under no circumstances may any law be passed which establishes a religion or advantages a particular religion in society. And so contemporary politics is trying, on both sides, is trying to come to terms with that process, it seems to me. Furthermore, from what Ed says, if the church can change its mind, then how does that fit in with the sort of legislative process that you're talking about? I don't know.
Thank you, and thank you very much, Ed. And John, I think you've really sort of hit mentioned quite an important element of this. And Ed, in your presentation, you sort of referred to that the binary between theology and society, I think it was. So much of religious faith has been influenced by politics, as we know. I mean, our history tells us that. So I guess the thought I had, and it's not a question, it's just a reflection on the extent to which theology too can be influenced by politics and by political movements, I suppose. And yeah, so and that's kind of where I would perhaps put Newman in a response to modernism. And yeah, it's very difficult, I think, to just really sort of separate them out, because as someone said, everything's politics. So thank you for listening.
And the other thing it seems to me is that, rightly or wrongly, I believe that an Australian attitude is that we do separate politics from religion. Church and state are separate. And I think that a lot of people were concerned, or have been concerned, that some people in the Liberal Party would like this party to become a Christian Democratic Party, and that people aren't very keen on the idea of a religiously based party. And so long as those things are mixed up in the political discourse, it's always going to be very difficult to get any sort of rational answer.
This might be a naive question, but to what extent shouldn't the debate recognise that there's pluralism in the church? I mean, it's incredibly obvious about birth control issues. It's a vast majority of Catholics do not think it's sinful to engage in birth control. Surely there is a pluralist church. It's inaccurate to talk about the church.
Not a dogmatic thing, but I was a principal of a state high school and also, when I retired, a catechist in the state system. When the state system set up, one of the conditions were that religious instruction was to be allowed to be given by various religious groups in state schools. However, the Catholics would not engage in it, and it wasn't until Cardinal Gilroy was Archbishop of Sydney, where he set up the Confraternity of Christian Doctrine in Sydney, and then Catholic scripture was taught in public schools. In fact, prior to that, I understand that there was quite a degree of discrimination within the church against those parents of students who were enrolled in public schools. Were you aware of those?
Oh, yes. Yes, can I rejoin the discussion? I was ordained before Vatican II, and so one of my first jobs when I went out into a parish was to be told by the parish priest, given a list of such parents who had their children in public schools, and they were to be asked fairly firmly to transfer the children to a Catholic school. But at the same time, I had been at St Patrick's College, Manly, in the first group to be priests who were trained to go into public schools and teach Catholicism. It very much depends on what year you're talking to. But yes, I published, as a publisher, I published once a book by University of New South Wales historian, where that was enforced with excommunication, and there's a famous case in the western New South Wales, the father of such a family could not be buried in a Catholic cemetery, so they built an enormous tomb for him outside the Catholic cemetery.
I grew up with parents. My father was a Catholic, my mother was a Presbyterian, and their faiths were very important to them. And after 9 years, they actually decided to marry against opposition from both their churches and their families. And they made an arrangement themselves that we would be baptised Catholics but go to state schools. My father then was not allowed to receive communion for the whole of that time, although he was a very devout man. My mother was told by her Presbyterian church not to show her face there, although her church had been extremely important to her. There was a good lady of the parish who would come to the state school to teach us the Penny Catechism and give us holy pictures if we knew all the answers. One memory I have, when my father would take us to Mass every Sunday, which was a very tense time because my mother was very unhappy about being banned from her church. And so there was this terrible tension on Sunday mornings. And then when we came back from Mass, suddenly the picnic basket would come out and the whole mood of the place would change. And nobody ever explained all these terrible tensions to me when I was a child. And then the Catholic scripture teacher told us it would be a good idea to pay a visit to the church in preparation for our Holy Communion. So I walked the kilometre up to the church, made a little visit, and as I was coming out, a nun came out of the school building and said, "What are you doing, little girl?" And I said, "I've just been making a visit." She said, "What church, what school do you go to?" I told her. She said, "You'll go to hell when you die." And so I ran all the way home and never spoke to another nun till I was middle-aged. I sent my children to the state school because the Catholic school that was close by had an untrained girl who was taking the three infants' classes, and the education was important to me. I also trained to become a catechist, which was a thorn in the side of the local priest. I taught as a catechist in the state schools, primary, for about 9 years. But when my first child was due to make his first communion, we had a very nice priest who was Maltese from background, and he thought it would be a nice idea if the children from the state school and the little convent made their first communions together. The parents, or mothers probably, from the Catholic school said they didn't think those children in the state school had the right to make their communion with the good little children at the Catholic schools. The priest then one morning made an appeal for a catechist, and so because I'd done the training, I volunteered to be a catechist, and so that became quite an issue. I had preschool children, and I said if somebody would mind my children, I would take the classes, which I did for about 9 years. So it's more complicated than it seems, actually. And my sister and I both married Catholics and stayed faithful to my father's teaching. My brother married a Presbyterian deaconess. And my parents were really involved in the ecumenical movement before it was even named like that. And there's actually a brass plaque in my mother's Presbyterian church in memory of my father and his contribution that he made to all the work with the Presbyterians. So as an old man, he would pick up all the old Catholic widows and take them up to early Mass, and then later in the morning he would pick up all the old Presbyterian widows and take them up to the Presbyterian church.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I had the impression that when Henry Parkes initiated state education in New South Wales as free, secular and compulsory, that the Catholic bishops were terribly afraid that this would lead to a dilution of the strength of the Catholic faith in New South Wales, in Australia, and that they set up the Catholic school system and made it a commandment of the Church. We were always taught when we were kids at school there were the Ten Commandments, and then there were the commandments of the Church, one of which was send Catholic children to Catholic schools.
In that discussion that we've had, it's alerted to me the compared to when I was a child to now, the growth of the ecumenical movement, you know, the Christian churches cooperating with each other. It wasn't part of the agenda that I recall when I was a child, and I think before that. But it's probably not really directly related, but I think it's a good story that I'll share with you. When I was principal of a school in Western Sydney at a very multicultural school, the local Anglican minister came up. He wanted to set up a prayer group. None of the churches provide scripture teachers at the school, but he wanted to set up a prayer group that could meet on Friday at lunchtime. And looking at the regulations, I set it up under the scripture operation. What they did was up to them, you know. And so the Catholics, not the Catholics, the Christians used to go to this scripture thing. Now, it turned out most of them, even though it was being supervised by an Anglican, most of them were actually Filipino Catholics. Shortly after that, the Muslim kids came to me and wanted to do the same sort of thing. And so we, on Fridays, they used to have a Christian prayer group, a Christian gathering for prayers and a Muslim gathering for prayers. And being a Friday, that was very important for Muslims. One Friday when I was... I'd been away for a week at a principal's conference and the lady in the front office came into my Hogan and said, and it came into my office and said, Mr Hogan, come into the foyer, come into the foyer. And I noticed there were two Franciscan friars who'd been invited down by the prayer group, and they were the white Franciscans, you know, in the grey habits. And there were also two Muslim mullahs there. What had happened is that while I was away, they had approached the school and the deputy had been acting principal and he'd given them permission to attend, which was quite okay. Anyway, I turned up into the foyer, looked at both of them and looked at the four of them and said, "What is this, an interfaith dialogue?"
Well, it remains to me to draw the discussion to a close by reinforcing what is a general view that this is an important topic and that you've thrown an important and new fresh light onto it. So thank you very much indeed. Next month's seminar will be by Mary Menas, the daughter of Sir John Eccles, the great Nobel Prize-winning Australian scientist. And she'll be talking about her experiences, and I'm sure that this topic of interfaith dialogue will come up yet again in Papua New Guinea. And so I would commend you all to come to that and to come as regularly as you can during the rest of the year. Thank you very much indeed.
Well done.
This ACHS podcast was recorded and produced by me, John Kenny, on lands whose first custodians were the Gadigal and Wallumettagal peoples of the Eora Nation. We'll be back in March. Bye for now.